don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on August 27th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel joined me to discuss the abusive proliferation of arbitration clauses and to discuss socializing ambulance services. All that and more is coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
Joining us on the line again from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on again.
So this is the first week of our new fall 2017 schedule where the episodes come out on Tuesday instead of on Wednesdays. Podcast listeners, that doesn't really affect you that much. But if you're listening on the radio on WVUD in Delaware, then this might be a new show for you because it's a new time slot. We're now at Tuesdays at noon instead of Wednesdays at 6 p.m. So this is a political show from the left where we talk about a lot of big ideas for changing the way we govern in America and do policy in America. A lot of our episodes focus on socializing services that are privatized and things like that that we feel would be better handled for the good of society by the government. And we talk about how exactly that would work and just making government work better in general. And so we cover a lot of these different topics. You can get all the back episodes on iTunes or at arsenalfordemocracy.com going all the way back to 2011. Although the show started out more as like a news of the week type of show. But definitely the past like just about a year now of episodes, and also a lot of our episodes in 2015 have focused a lot less on the news other than a few like, you know, current events type news hooks for stories and more about kind of the bigger picture on things. So this week we're going to be talking about arbitration clauses in the first segment, and then we're going to be talking about ambulance services in the second segment. So arbitration clauses have definitely been on the rise for kind of buried in contracts, both with consumers and with employee-employer relationships, workers often having to sign away their rights to like sue basically against their employer if something goes wrong, and similarly consumers waiving their rights to sue often with like a credit card company or something like that. Now, you know, the sort of conservative response to complaints about this has been, well, then you should have just not signed this contract, although many people are not aware of the arbitration clauses being in the contracts in the first place, because nobody is really reading sort of the pages and pages and pages of like dense agreements that they often have to sign. The other thing is you have to sign a lot of them. There's a lot of cases where your ability to sort of exist in the modern world depends on you signing a contract that is involved in one of these things. Now, the sort of thing that has put this back in the news again lately is that 20 U.S. State Attorney General officials have offices, including, I think, led by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, have it's not like they've put together a lawsuit, I don't think. They've just said that they are very concerned that the Republican-controlled Congress is considering repealing a rule that was passed, I assume, as part of probably as part of Dodd-Frank or maybe the authorizing law for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They're considering rolling back a rule regarding arbitration clauses, which would make the situation even worse if that happened. And so there's been some pressure from the attorneys general on that front at the state level. And then also the Consumer Protection the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau chief, Richard Cordray, has also been kind of pushing on that issue because he, I guess, if I remember correctly, he just, I don't know if he has a term that hasn't ended yet or they just haven't figured out what to do with him. But they, either way, they haven't replaced him yet under the Trump administration. And so he had an op-ed as well about this recently. That those attorneys general were promoting. So, Nate, where do we start on this topic, the sort of the rise of the arbitration clauses and the abuses that that leads to?
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to look at this op-ed that Cordray wrote in New York Times a couple days ago and just sort of look at sort of the dynamics that are in play here. And he talks about how a lot of this, these arbitration clauses, they often come up for, it's very individualized, it's for it's oftentimes larger payouts, but if there's a lot of people seeking, you know, a relatively smaller amount of money, you know, they often don't undergo individualized arbitration just because they don't feel like it's worth it or anything, but if they actually were able to have a joint suit or something like that, it would be much easier to get back that money. He quotes one judge noting, only a lunatic or a fanatic sues for $30. So if that's the issue you have with your bank, it's probably going to be much harder to go through all the legal stuff and arbitration to just try to get back a little bit versus maybe if they took thousands of out of your account, you might be more likely to go to arbitration.
And it seemed like, I mean, the numbers that you can get, that you're likely to get, it's just night and day, like the disparity there, right?
Yeah, there was about 16 people per year recovered around a little bit less than $100,000 total. So it's really a small amount of people who do this every year.
Yeah, and then, but then, like, yeah, you can get, you know, there's class action suits, as we know, often millions and potentially billions a year. And those are not, like, easy either. And I guess one of the, like, common talking points that was mentioned in that article, I think, was like this notion that like these class action suits are just about the lawyers and somehow enriching the lawyers or whatever. But even so, though, like they said, the percentage that goes to the, you know, for legal fees is relatively small. And even so, like people don't usually get that much money out of these class action suits either. Like the individuals are not like making a ton of money off of them there because it's split over such a large population. I don't know. It seems like that, as with many areas of any of these companies and financial sectors, it's always just a slap on the wrist to these companies, no matter what it is. But the question is, like, how big of a slap is it?
Yeah, and the question to do with like legal fees and stuff, this article points out that for every $10 a company pays out for wrongdoing, about $8 goes to the consumer and $2 goes to pay legal costs, and they often have access to pretty high-profile lawyers and such. So,
right, whereas arbitration, that's none of that's there.
Yeah, and the so the potential cost of the rule for the entire financial system, it's basically around under $1 billion per year, whereas banks are making, you know, around $171 billion in profits last year, for example.
Yeah, so even under the class action system, it's not like these companies are getting completely slammed or something, which maybe they should be because a lot of them are very abusive.
Right, and Cordray brings up the example of Wells Fargo, which had a scandal recently with they were opening all sorts of phony bank accounts for people, and then a group lawsuit against it was blocked by the arbitration clauses, so that pushed them into, you know, the behind the closed door back and forth instead of a group lawsuit.
Rachel, did you have any thoughts on this?
Something that was concerning to me was credit cards getting hacked. So you read quite often about Target or Home Depot getting their credit card systems hacked and a lot of information gets leaked. And for the consumer, there's little to no recourse available to them because it's blocked by these arbitration clauses, which I think is very important for consumer protections, where we just can't fight back against these and demand that these credit card companies heighten their security, or these big corporations like Home Depot or Target heighten their security for their credit card systems.
Yeah, and that was the other interesting thing, is that they were talking about the difference between companies suing other companies versus individuals and doing class action suits and things like that. Like even the some of the business to business suits have been affected by some of these sort of arbitration provisions, although they have more resources to break those agreements and fight that off and say, no, you're going to actually do a lawsuit here because this is a significant thing. But yeah, it is concerning that like all of it is just about seems to be about just chipping away any sort of consumer power and autonomy in the system, and sort of it's consumer financial protection. That's that's Cordray's whole job, essentially. It seems like really it's a bad trend for a lot of reasons. I feel like it's very parallel to the topic we had done several weeks ago, Rachel, with you and your sister Sarah talking about those non-compete clauses that they're throwing into like the Jimmy John's contract for workers. Like, it's that sort of level of absurdity that it gets taken to eventually, where it's just, you know, it's filtering down into every possible contract, no matter how ordinary and everyday, so that no one has any sort of recourse for anything, and the sort of labor market is completely controlled by these clauses. Similarly, I think we had talked about both on that contract episode, as well as some of the episodes regarding scheduling flexibility, and sort of the contracts that people sign there. A lot of this stuff ultimately ties back into bigger picture societal issues like harassment and things like that. And I think that was something that both of you had mentioned in relation to this topic, on and off the air, basically that you know, if there's like a sexual harassment incident or something at a company, then that kind of affects things. Nate, you were going to say something.
Yeah, so congressional Democrats introduced legislation called the Arbitration Fairness Act several times in sort of the early to mid-2000s, like between 2009 and 2013. Hasn't received a vote. You know, it's not going to pass, obviously, but it would eliminate mandatory arbitration for employment or consumer realms, antitrust civil rights cases. So that's sort of what's been pushing forward. But there actually was a executive order put forward by the Obama administration in coordination with a Al Franken amendment for the Defense Appropriations Act of 2010, which basically would ban which would eliminate arbitration for defense contractors above a certain, I guess, about 1 million in contracts. And a lot of this would actually touch on allegations of sexual assault, harassment, discrimination, a lot of times going back to, say, female employees of like Halliburton, things like that. So there was Fair Play and Safe Workplaces executive order put out by Obama in 2014. Applies to all federal contractors with contracts greater than $1 million and bars these contractors from enforcing mandatory arbitration agreements and claims based on, I think it's Title 8 or Title 7 or tort claims involving sexual assault and harassment. But the Trump administration took that executive order away. So we're seeing that being rolled back, basically.
Now, Rachel, do you also see these parallels that I'm seeing in terms of the sort of workplace control or labor market control and workplace safety issues that get brought up as a result of this concern?
Yeah, it what we've seen over these past few weeks by touching on these different topics is that we've just kind of seen this really insidious, quiet, behind the scenes stripping of employee protections and rights. And I think that just kind of goes to show that we need a stronger labor movement, our collective power coming together to fight against these stripping of our powers and rights as workers.
Now, I wanted to talk about this big report that was released in December of 2015 from the Economic Policy Institute. It's called The Arbitration Epidemic: Mandatory Arbitration Deprives Workers and Consumers of Their Rights. Nate, this is obviously a pretty huge paper, but you were skimming through it to pull out some of the key highlights that people should know. And I guess this is partly about identifying the problem, but also partly about coming up with solutions to it, where we go from here beyond just sort of specific bills or executive orders that have been floated and not gone anywhere ultimately. What is it that we should know from this EPI report in 2015?
Right. So some of the information I was just talking about, specifically involving the Arbitration Fairness Act, is one of the solutions they do suggest of trying to solve some of these problems. But it, you know, they also note that there have been court rulings that have gone against the National Labor Relations Board in their efforts to curtail the use of arbitration agreements and other such things. So, you know, it sort of seems like people are starting to identify the problem, but they don't really quite have the means to leverage against it, just because, you know, Congress is quite friendly to these sorts of corporations. And
I guess they said, as you were kind of alluding to there, that the Supreme Court in particular has been very favorable toward this push toward arbitration over the past several decades.
Yeah, and that's sort of a pretty significant problem. And you even have situations, I believe, and I'm not sure about the exact cases, but even some of the more supposedly moderate or liberal Supreme Court justices are quite friendly towards these type of corporate arbitration. So
yeah, which I guess speaks to the issue of how do we define liberal and conservative judges, because a lot of the ones that are appointed by the liberal presidents tend to be quote unquote pro-business on some aspects, some more so than others. And you know, the EPI report highlights a lot of the same things that were mentioned in that shorter Richard Cordray op-ed. You know, the idea that you win less and receive less in damages in arbitration than you do in court, that sort of thing. But there's some other aspects as well here that are important to.
Yeah, they note that in the few years since the Supreme Court upheld the use of class action bans coupled with arbitration clauses, I guess there was a case a couple of years ago. But they've since said that this type of composite clause has become ubiquitous, I'm quoting now, in the small print governing employment, credit cards, cell phones, bank accounts, internet providers, and countless other types of everyday transactions. So it's becoming ubiquitous, yeah.
Getting back to these sort of labor rights issues, there's a good example in here. It's actually under the header, an example of arbitration, and they were talking about how somebody had worked at as a staff assistant at Ernst & Young, and she had like a fixed salary, but then of course she was having to work a lot of overtime, but they had classified her in such a way that she was exempt from overtime, and she would have made a bunch more money, not like a huge amount, but a you know, significant chunk of money more if she had been getting you know, paid a certain way. And she tried to file a class action suit, and then they said, no, your contract actually had this arbitration clause that you didn't realize. And then, you know, so they go back and forth with the state courts and the federal courts and that sort of thing. This is a pretty dense article, so I do encourage people to take a look at it themselves. It's got a lot of kind of details of how this evolved over time, and this is a very, very comprehensive paper.
Yeah, one thing that, just to switch to a more foreign policy type of realm, but this sort of does remind me, when we're talking about arbitration, when like in the, say, late like 19th century or something, the U.S. would send gunboat diplomacy type of envoys down to like you know, small Central American or South American countries. And then once they've, you know, seized resources or done some gunboat diplomacy, then they would invite international arbitration you know, boards to come down and, you know, solve some sort of disagreement. And that sort of reminds me of this, in the sense that there's, you know, you have a supposedly impartial arbitrator, but then that doesn't really take into account the power imbalances between various groups, where you know, where you have a large corporation and then, you know, individualized complainants rather than like a mass of people joined together. And so that's sort of a weird parallel, but does remind me of that.
Right. And for sure, I mean, to Rachel's point about collective power, like the class action suit is sort of the legal world's equivalent of unions in terms of collective bargaining. In this case, it's collective lawsuits. And I think also, like, I don't know exactly who the judges typically are, or whatever. I don't know if they're called judges, but whoever the arbitration person is that ultimately makes the decision, I don't know in these particular cases usually, like, where does that person come from? Like, what's their legal background or whatever? I know in other aspects, sort of the modern day version of what Nate was just talking about is, and this is something we've talked about as well, the tribunals in various free trade deals, investor state dispute resolution tribunals. Those are a form of arbitration. And in those cases, and this is, again, this is a foreign policy like trade issue, but in those cases, almost all the arbitration judges, the tribunal judges, are former employees or even executives of the type of companies that are being regulated. And I would guess that it's probable that a lot of the people in these sort of individual level arbitration things are also have some sort of a corporate background in some capacity or other. And then so you have to wonder, well, are you really getting a fair shot in your one-on-one thing? And that's even if you set aside the fact that going up one-on-one against a giant corporation in a little, you know, closed arbitration process is probably not particularly fair as well.
It also touched on in the report that the employers tend to choose the same arbitrators over and over again, so they do kind of get that home field advantage. The individual going up against them is different every time, but the arbitrator becomes familiar with these employers, and it's hard to not be biased if you're seeing the same people over and over again.
That's true, yeah. Also, an interesting point that they make in the paper is that the use of the arbitration clauses in employment contracts actually originated as part of a union push, which is ironic from sort of our perspective today. But basically, this was up until the 1990s. They were generally being put into contracts by the unions to ensure that the unionized workplace contracts were being enforced with the full union protections that had been worked out. And you didn't necessarily, like, you didn't need to go to a lawsuit or something because it was, you know, this is the agreement that we made. This is our collective bargaining agreement. And then, you know, you're just saying, okay, this is the process that we're going to go through to make sure that this is enforced. We don't need to go to a lawsuit or something like that. But then, of course, they, you know, the employers figured out that they could use it in non-union workplaces, and then you don't have that bilateral partner. So that's like kind of a compromise point that you could make, is that you don't necessarily need to go to a model that's all like lawsuit oriented if you don't want to. But in order to have that be a fair trade-off, you would have to have significant unionization again. You'd have to say arbitration clauses can only be in contracts where there's also a collective bargaining agreement with a union, because then the union can advocate for you in that arbitration process. So that's like another sort of interesting dynamic there. And the proliferation as well in consumer contracts is just enormous. They have a ton of statistics. I'm not going to go through all of them here. Credit cards and prepaid cards are overwhelmingly, you know, controlled by these arbitration clauses, which really limits your power if there's some sort of problem with the credit card or they steal your money. You know, previously on the show, we've talked about those prepaid Rush cards. Russell Simmons Rush card, with a journalist friend of mine who was looking into this. Basically, what happened there, as I recall, and you can go and look on arsenalfordemocracy.com to get the episode that has all the details, but what happened there was that people, they were doing some sort of like system update or something, and all of a sudden people's money was like unavailable, and eventually they could get back to it. But the problem was, this is a card that was one that, you know, people would deposit their paycheck directly to it, and they would pay all their bills with it. And if they had deposited their entire paycheck on it, then they had no access to any of their money that they had duly been paid by their employer, and they couldn't pay any of their bills. And it happened right around, I think, the end of the month or something. So a lot of people were trying to, you know, pay their rent or pay their utilities, that kind of thing. And like, that can destroy people's lives. And I don't know what the ultimate outcome there was. I don't know. I'm assuming there was arbitration clauses involved, but I'm guessing a lot of people were just completely out of luck, you know. And whether or not it was in that particular case, this is sort of symptomatic of like a larger trend here, where if you run into a problem with your card, and that could really ruin your life if it hits at the wrong moment, even if it's quote unquote temporary, then, you know, you're out of luck because you're stuck in this arbitration process. And 90% of those arbitration related contracts prohibit class action suits explicitly. And, you know, so that's then you're stuck with these private tribunals that are don't have any sort of standardization to them. In many cases, they're talking. There's a whole section on the arbitration process where you can look up into that and see how like it kind of varies a lot from place to place and circumstance to circumstance. Anyway, it's generally bad all around. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting from a meta standpoint to like talk about is that if you just Google, you know, something like the rise of arbitration clauses or something along those lines, it's just dozens of articles stretching back quite a few years now at this point of talking about this. And yet there doesn't seem to be that much momentum on it. I don't even think like, I could be wrong, but I don't think like consumer protection really came up that much in the presidential election last year from really any of the candidates. I mean, maybe Bernie Sanders mentioned it or something, but I don't even remember that. Like, it doesn't seem to be a huge thing. Obviously, the one politician who really, really pushes consumer financial protection is Elizabeth Warren. She's the one who got the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau set up in the first place. That's sort of her like really strong pet issue that she cares a lot about and knows a lot about. But this is like a growing problem that doesn't seem to be really on the radar of the policymakers and politicians that much, except occasionally when we get things like that Franken Amendment. So, you know, this is something that really impacts people's lives kind of in a quiet way. And it would be good to really rule those out or significantly overhaul how they're handled. And again, that HR issue is definitely a huge problem, which they also have a section on that in the EPI paper, just that, like, you know, if you're not getting paid appropriately, if you're being sexually harassed in the workplace, if you're being asked to do things that aren't within your contract, things like that. If there's an internal workplace dispute, a lot of those are kind of getting handled through various arbitration procedures with leaving you no particular recourse to deal with a lot of this stuff. And in the past, a lot of sort of workplace civil rights issues, discrimination issues have been resolved by doing a lawsuit, whether it's class action or individual. That's how you know, kind of deal with that. And so that's why we need to definitely be doing something to sort of change this situation and fix this situation. And like Nate said, they have in this EPI paper, they have a what can be done section that has various mentions of the specific thing, like the Franken Amendment, the Arbitration Fairness Act, various things the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau could do. But as we talked about at the top of the segment, they can only do that if they have that power and Congress hasn't taken away that power, which they are currently pushing to do. Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Idaho is Rachel. We're going to talk now in this segment about ambulance services. They are typically privatized, which many people don't realize. We're talking in the United States, but they're actually also privatized in other countries as well. And we're going to talk in particular about Canada because it is so similar to the U.S. setup, despite the fact that they have a single payer system there for the rest of their healthcare. And this is something that, like, for some reason, there's not a ton of pressure, as far as I can tell, from the public to really change how we do things, even though this is one of the areas where people have actually had the most direct interaction with the healthcare system being a nightmare. And that's something that we'll talk about a little bit. But basically, like, people often find themselves, you know, either not realizing or not having a choice. They end up in an ambulance, and that ends up being like the huge, huge cost of their healthcare relative to the sort of the rest of the costs. You know, that can run thousands of dollars, that can run many thousands of dollars, depending on like how far you're going, you know, what the level of critical care you require in, you know, when you're in the ambulance, that sort of thing. And we have cases where people die because they don't want to or can't afford to take the ambulance. We have, you know, people giving birth in vehicles that aren't ambulances because they couldn't get to the hospital in time. And, you know, who knows? I mean, not that like you want to give birth in an ambulance either, probably, but like, you know, sometimes people, their options are constrained by the fact that these very expensive ambulances that they don't quite realize or that they know that they're not going to be able to afford, present a problem with them. So despite the fact that this is a key area of interaction that people have with the healthcare system, this is something that doesn't get talked about that much, as we'll explore a little bit. Rachel, where do we start on this topic?
Well, you mentioned Canada. So ambulance fees in Canada are province-based. So in Ontario, it's $45 for an ambulance ride, and it can go all the way up to more than $500 in parts of Manitoba.
Still great compared to us, but...
Yeah, exactly, but... if you're in Manitoba, you're kind of screwed. It seems like the only exception is Yukon Territories, and I imagine it's just because there's so few people living there that it just isn't worth it to charge them for ambulance services. According to a CBC article, 42% said they might delay calling an ambulance because of the cost. And in an emergency, that can be the difference between life or death. Those precious minutes where you're discussing, can I afford this? And also it mentioned people dying in their spouse's vehicles on the way to the hospital, because the important part of ambulances is there's EMTs there to stabilize you on the way to the hospital to get you to the hospital alive in the first place. So it can be very important, the difference between life and death, and cost should not be one of the considerations you're making when you're trying to decide whether to call an ambulance or not.
And I think the reason that we're starting out by highlighting Canada is because, as with some of the other topics that we've discussed, when we did the dental care one, a listener pointed out that we'd actually gotten some of the details wrong on that, and that in Canada, you also had to get like a separate sort of insurance plan to deal with dental, even though the rest of the system is single payer. Like, these are some areas where it's illustrative to look at a country like Canada relative to the US, where we don't have really any setup of anything, because then you can see like, okay, you know, it's not enough to say, okay, we get this main part covered by a single payer system, now we're done. Like, you have to look at all the sort of related ancillary parts of this, whether it's dental insurance or whether it's ambulance coverage, things like that. Something that, as we're starting from such a low baseline in the United States and trying to design a system, like, where do we go from here? What do we want to build? Because that's been actually a criticism that we've seen in, you know, recent months, is people expressing concern, whether they're doing it cynically or sincerely, saying like, well, I'm concerned that a single payer system in the United States will look like X, Y, or Z and will lack coverage for A, B, or C. And we're saying, okay, like, that's a valid thing to take into consideration. Let's make sure we design a system that actually deals with this. One of the other challenges, I think, is that, as Rachel mentioned, in Canada, it's provincially based. In the United States, it would probably be at the municipal level, I'm guessing, or maybe the county level, something like that. Maybe depending on the state and your level of ruralness, it might be a state handled thing if you were to do it, if you were to socialize ambulance services. But at the moment, it's sort of this chaotic, crazy patchwork of private companies, which I believe they also often have like specific contracts with certain hospitals in an area where there's multiple hospitals. If it's an area with just one hospital, then it's going to go to that hospital. But if there's multiple hospitals, then you have to worry about, well, is the ambulance going to take me to the correct hospital? I think that's an issue in places like Delaware, where there's a lot of healthcare, but it's very weirdly sort of distributed out. In Massachusetts, where I live, you've got this, some of the hospitals are very spread out in the rural parts of the state, but you've also got the Boston area, where most of the hospitals are very tightly sort of compacted into a single area. And, you know, you could go to any hospital and it wouldn't take you that much, like, it wouldn't affect your time to get there. But the question is, are they going to be acting in your best interest from a financial standpoint? And these are all things that people should not have to worry about, as Rachel said. These are life and death decisions that are wasting precious moments in your ability to get to the hospital on time and be stabilized and everything. I think probably in general, like municipal level would be a good place to handle it. I think this is also something, if you're the modern day equivalent of early 20th century sewer socialists, which were focused on basically deprivatizing certain services that were being mishandled by the private sector at a local level and turning those over to city control, this is a great example of something, especially if you're not in a rural area. If you're in one of these sort of more urban areas, it would be great to just have one ambulance service that you don't have to worry about making sure it's the right one, so to speak, and that you know that it'll get you to the nearest hospital, and that it's not going to break the bank. And the fact that the other reason to cite Canada, the fact that people, they had those statistics like, 40% roughly or whatever of people saying that they, were making decisions about whether or not to take an ambulance, and the costs were so much lower. I mean, obviously 500 in Manitoba, which is quite rural, but even in Ontario, like people were making decisions partly based on those costs. Like, if that's how much people are making a decision based on, and that's a small amount, think about what it is here. Like, it must be very, very high. And the fact that there isn't a lot of pressure from the public and political figures is kind of interesting to me. Like, the insurance companies we hear a lot about, we hear a lot less about ambulance companies, or we only hear about it to the extent of like, oh, the insurance company denied coverage for the ambulance ride. And like, that's put entirely on the insurance company as opposed to examining like both halves of that equation. Nate?
Yeah. Going back to Canada just for one second, there are some studies that also show that 19% of people have delayed calling an ambulance because of fees. And it was highest in Alberta at about 25%. So that's a pretty significant chunk, even in Canada. You mentioned in the United States, we saw the higher limit in Canada was around $500. There's a article in the LA Times from 2013 basically saying that, yeah, it was about $1,000 in LA. And oftentimes it can vary depending on what hospital you're going to, if you've got Medicare, Medicaid, various things. So it can range from $200 to about $2,200, according to a 2012 GAO report. So there's a lot of variation also in terms of, what insurance type of plan you have, if Medicare, Medicaid, things like that. Also worth pointing out that some of these companies that provide ambulance services are being bought up by, say, private equity. So there's an article from August 8th saying private equity firm KKR bought up the Air Medical Group Holdings, which operates a fleet of ambulances. And it's, I believe it's one of the largest in the United States, 5 million patients, 46 states. So.
Yeah, and that's part of a bigger trend as well that we've talked about on the show previously, this pattern of private equity companies purchasing up urgent care facilities, basically, oh, it's low margin, but it's high turnover, so you can make a bunch of money on that. And like, none of this stuff should be like about making money. This should be about providing a service. And if you're doing it to make money, then you're necessarily going to be driving the costs up and you're trying to get profits out of it. Like, that's clearly a bad incentive to be putting profits into ambulance services. And I think it's weird too. Like, I think a lot of things, fire departments in the past had been privately run, that sort of thing. Police, even in many cases, historically, a long, long time ago, those used to be private entities. Eventually, they got socialized. They got acquired by the local municipality or county or whatever. And why hasn't that happened with ambulances? That's an interesting question. There was also some statistics, I think it was in a Los Angeles Times article from 2013 that was kind of going over some of these basic data points about the growing crisis situation. A lot of these ambulance companies are routinely misfiling the paperwork to get people, like, to get it covered by insurance or Medicare. And like, they'll say, they'll file it, this was a non-emergency service, or that they didn't actually require an ambulance. And it's like, well, why'd you file the paperwork that way? Because now there's going to be an automatic denial from Medicare or from the insurance company, and then the person's going to be stuck paying the bill on their own when in fact they did have to and it was an emergency. Rachel?
Yeah, and it's really kind of cruel because you're dealing with a health crisis, and then you have to fight your insurance company at the same time. It just seems very uncaring and cold to have to deal with these things when really it should just be without a thought that we get to access our medical care, we we have peace of mind around people taking care of us, but that often is not the case.
Yeah, there's a quote in the article about Canada from a parent whose child died of a respiratory disorder. You're taught as a child, if there's an emergency, you call 911. But when you call 911, no one tells you there's a bill attached with that phone call. So that's obviously a pretty tragic situation. And yeah, that shouldn't be someone people are thinking about. As there's the Paramedic Association of Canada president who says that, you know, people are dying in their cars. It probably also drives up costs overall if people are coming in worse shape because they're not in a an ambulance. Also, I think it's worth noting, Bill, you mentioned about sort of looking at this on the municipal level and just doing research for this segment, just looking at a bunch of small towns across America, you know, Sioux City, Iowa, or say Muncie, Indiana. They're looking at providing ambulance services from the municipal fire department or just trying to do something else. Because I guess in Muncie, Indiana, they're a federal safer grant funding is potentially running out, and that could damage them. And they're looking at ways of providing ambulance services by the city instead of, say, farming it out to a private company, or they're looking at. So, you know, this is something that a lot of small cities and municipalities are probably struggling with all across the country, especially in rural areas, as we've talked about. So I think this is something that's going to continue to be something that does get discussed and taken action upon in these small towns.
Now, my impression here, obviously, we've been talking about kind of the crisis situation as it exists, and Rachel has made the point that this isn't something you should have to be worrying about or thinking about in the moment. It should just be covered by, you know, tax dollars and then, like, the fire department. Like, you know, it's going to show up when you need it, and it's not going to be, there's not going to be a debate about it, and there's not going to be a billing crisis later. But, you know, And Nate is bringing up the point here that there are some communities that are starting to explore the possibility of socializing their ambulance services based on various fiscal pressures and concerns and that sort of thing. The thing that I was curious about, and Rachel and I looked into it a little bit but had a lot of trouble coming up with hard data, is this an industry that is politically influential? You know, the insurance industry, we talk a lot about how much money they donate and how much lobbying money they spend and that sort of thing. And that kind of helps keep a lot of politicians in their pocket on the issue of the health insurance industry and preventing socialization or nationalization there. But we tried to look up data for the ambulance companies, and this is where it sort of gets interesting here. So as I've been emphasizing throughout, despite the fact that this is an area where a lot of people are interacting regularly and interfacing directly with the companies and they know how bad the situation is, this doesn't seem to have been a major push yet in terms of thinking about, like, lobbying your politicians to change how we do things. This doesn't seem there. You know, there's a groundswell increasingly for things like Medicare for All, that sort of thing. But there doesn't seem to be a push on ambulances. Now, a big part of that is obviously just that people don't seem to be aware that they're privatized in many cases, even when they get that huge bill. But for whatever reason, there hasn't been a big push on that. So that's one factor why I think we were having trouble finding some of the campaign donation data, is that unlike the insurance industry, they don't actually have to spend that much probably because they aren't really in jeopardy of being socialized or nationalized. There's no significant public push on that. I looked on, you know, Open Secrets data, FEC data, and, you know, they'll spend a few a few hundred thousand dollars on lobbying at the federal level, you know, donate maybe tens of thousands of dollars through a PAC or whatever. And then individually, it's, you know, maybe a page and not even a page and a half of results in the FEC donor database. If you just search for, you know, you can search by employer, basically, and look, just search ambulance as the employer keyword, and then any company with the name ambulance in it, that would come up there. And that's a very limited pool of data. Again, though, that's the federal level. And if you stop and think about it, that makes sense. There's not going to be a lot of contributions at the federal level because this is not a federal issue. This is really, in many cases, a very localized issue. Obviously, if there were a big push to have like Medicare take over all ambulance services or something like that, that would become a federal issue. And I'm sure they would increase their donations and lobbying. But at the moment, this is something that is typically handled at a very local level and probably would be. I don't think this would be a thing that Medicare would handle directly. I think it's something that, you know, would be worked out between municipalities, counties, that sort of thing with the hospitals. And maybe the insurance companies, depending on where we are in the sort of overall reform process. But the other thing that makes it difficult to look up is just that because this is a local issue, or at the most a state issue, it becomes very difficult to look up the campaign finance spending because databases across states and municipalities and everything are very inconsistent in how they report, what you can search, that sort of thing. I tried to look up the Delaware data, for example. I'm not really a big fan of the Delaware campaign finance system, which I've worked with before. And you can't really even search by keyword for employer. So unlike in Massachusetts, where I could search, any company, anybody that donated as an individual who works at a company with ambulance in the name, I couldn't figure out how to do that for Delaware. California, I tried a similar search, got zero results. That seems unlikely to me, but I don't know if that's a database issue or maybe the companies are only spending at the local level. I don't know. Massachusetts is a state where we have this huge, you know, hospital area in the Boston area, the Longwood Medical and a whole bunch of other hospitals outside of that. There's obviously a lot of ambulances taking people to and from various hospitals. And that was a state where I had no trouble finding the data there, although we don't know what they're necessarily doing at the municipal level if it's not in the state database yet. But statewide, there was like $600,000 in contributions from people who work at ambulance companies. And overwhelmingly, if you look to see what the occupation at those companies was, it would be CEO, executive, vice president, marketing director, you know, government services, that kind of thing. It's all lobbyists and executives at these companies making $1,000 donations to, you know, the governor's campaign or the state senate and state house leadership, that sort of thing. These are influential donors on a local level where a little bit of money goes a long way. So even if they're not spending on the same scale as the insurance industry, either they are already spending enough to keep this off the radar, or if we started doing a push like what Nate was talking about in, you know, Iowa or Indiana or something like that, we would probably see the spending increase from those companies as they basically try to maintain their privileges and prevent socialization or public competition. Rachel, did you have any other luck finding any of the campaign donation data that we had been trying, I think, in vain to find in many cases?
Idaho, it was extremely difficult. I did try to find the Open Secrets website, but it wouldn't load. I don't know if that's a sign or anything. But I did find a 2015 Idaho Statesman article that just kind of broke contributions down by sector. And health was less than 10% of campaign contributions. So I don't think it's a huge issue in Idaho. Probably because we do have so many rural communities and because ambulance services are so decentralized. I don't know if it's a big deal on the state level versus the municipality or county level.
And if this became a central issue on the radar, I mean, you would expect that this is probably we're going to see an increase in the spending, right?
Right, exactly. But it kind of broke down the top 50 non-individual contributors, and while insurance companies and hospital lobbying groups were pretty high up there, it didn't really break it down by ambulance services or anything like that. So
right, and I think that's part of the problem here is it's going to be if people start pushing to socialize ambulance services, there's going to be a lot of difficulty in seeing the pushback start to happen from these ambulance companies because of how non-standard all the reporting is at the municipal level, county level, even state level in many cases. And I just don't think that we're going to see a similar federal level push, particularly unless they push Congress to, like, which they could these days, that's something they would do, is push Congress to ban state and municipal takeover of ambulance services, because that's the kind of thing that they like basically tried to prevent socialization by counties and cities of high speed internet, fiber optic internet, that kind of thing. they didn't want public competition to the private companies, so they just passed bans basically on that and said you couldn't do that. And so that seems like something they would probably also consider trying to do as well. Nate, any other sort of closing thoughts on this particular topic?
I mean, I think the real key is that there's going to be a lot of smaller towns and, you know, smaller cities as well that really struggle with this issue. And, you know, if you have got someone living, you know, pretty far away from, say, large hospital centers like Longwood or anything like that, and they're being charged hundreds and thousands of dollars just for a simple ambulance ride, you know, you sort of wonder, you know, how is that sustainable? How is that going to lead to just people either not going for care that they absolutely desperately need, and potentially people dying in their cars and things like that? So I think this, you know, needs to be part of the broader healthcare debate overall. It's not just enough to say, okay, we need Medicare for all or something like that. We need to have a sort of a broader holistic view and really tie this in to, you know, the campaigns for Medicare for all. And, you know, that would potentially, I think, boost both of them in a way that, you know, bringing them together, that they might, it might be harder to focus on, say, ambulance services individually.
Right. And I think the Canada examples that we brought up really underscore that point, that it needs to be taken together in a holistic view. Also, I think to your point there about raising both of these issues together and the profile of both of them together, as I've been saying, like, this is an issue. Ambulance costs is an issue that many Americans are directly familiar with themselves. But it yet remains this issue that's not that high profile and not really high on people's radars. So tying it in with other stuff like Medicare for All, I think is actually a good idea in terms of bringing up that profile and underscoring it. Rachel, your closing thoughts on this. I know you've been trying to emphasize that this, just from a common sense standpoint, should be a socialized service, not a privatized service.
Yeah, I think this ties in with the conversations we've had about healthcare and other privatized or decentralized services in the past. When these private services offer a lesser product for more money, it just doesn't really make sense. So as we've said in the past, we should be pushing for these centralized public services.
I was going to just cut in there because I was remembering something you said off air before the show that you wanted to touch on as well. And this ties into the issue of what is a private service versus what is a service that doesn't need to be privatized. Like, if you call 911, typically you're not really like requesting as a consumer, oh, I want this particular private competitor to provide ambulance services. But you said in Idaho, there are some cases maybe where that does come into play.
Well, I know if I were to call 911 here in Boise, which is in Ada County, I would be getting an Ada County paramedic ambulance, which, despite the name, is not a public service. So they would take me to the closest hospital. They're not contracted with a particular hospital, but they would charge my insurance unless I was even if I was a member. A membership costs $60 per year, and it does cover the entire household. But this just isn't something that you think about normally. Like, do I need to be a member of my fire station? No, because it's a public service. So it's this kind of false public service because it is in the name, but they're not offering a public good at this time.
But it should be a public good.
Yes, it definitely should be. Like, we shouldn't be thinking about memberships. And also, a hospital does offer air ambulatory services, just in case. We go camping quite often, and if an emergency happened out in the middle of nowhere, we would want to probably be members of that air ambulance service, which is, again, something you don't think about normally, but we are kind of unique in that we're such a rural state.
And this used to, of course, be, you know, not to get off topic, but that used to be the model for fire departments actually as well, was that it was run by a fire insurance company, and you had to be a member of a specific company and put a little shield on your house that said which company you were a member of. And they would only put out your fire, if you weren't a member, they would only put out your fire if it was going to jeopardize a neighboring house that they did have under their insurance. So this is a good example of something that, like, it doesn't really matter what the origins of it were. Eventually you get to a point where it should just be socialized. And that's what we feel that we've reached that point on ambulance services, certainly. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us this week to talk about these two issues.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.